Dr. Shab. This is Courtney Hilgo calling.
Yes, hi, Courtney. Hi.
Hi.
Well, the first question, what got you interested?
Mm-hmm.
I would say at the most personal level, it was just awareness of my own nervousness and tendency to worry and having bad images go through my head, you know, all related to fear.
Sure.
But that's the most personal level. I think, you know, I saw it in people around me as well.
Mm-hmm.
Just in general, I was just aware of it, I guess is the best answer to give.
Mm-hmm.
And the other answer is that my first job out of college, I was a caseworker with heroin addicts. And I saw that when they were in recovery, they were just basically sensitive people overwhelmed by the world.
Mm-hmm.
And they weren't sort of like these tough criminals that they seemed to be on the outside.
Right.
And so that it struck me, like, you know, what other people are doing what things to deal with this feeling. But
yeah.
I did see it in people around me. And
sure.
I also had the sense that the people who appeared to be unafraid were really masking how they felt.
Yeah. Yeah, it wasn't ringing true. I guess what I'm attracted to in your philosophy or your theory is that rather than suggesting mastery, you seem really to be talking more about serenity or, you know, a way of being more connected. So that's sort of my impression of what's different about your conclusions. But what do you think? You know, how do you feel like you teach people to handle fear differently than they're normally taught?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I think you said it very well just now. I think I'll write that down, actually. that was nice and clear.
thank you.
I would say that the way that I see it differently is that I consider fear to be absolutely normal,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and to be respected.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And to be treated in a certain way.
Uh-huh.
So I don't pathologize it
uh-huh.
at all. It doesn't become a disorder for me.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, okay, this is reality. This is part of reality. And how to be with this part of reality? And is there a way to be okay with, you know, as you said, serene, is there a way to be okay or even better with
mm-hmm.
this fact of life?
That really does go against the grain of, you know, what people are being taught right now. I think, I mean, just with sort of overwhelmingly pushed to thinking positive, and if you think any other way, you're attracting things to you that are, you know, negative. And
right.
That's like the worst thing you can say to a nervous person.
right.
You're already convinced you're attracting things.
Right.
So
yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think we get into these things later in the questions, but I could just also just put it in now that I think there's the potential in fear to get to something good. It's
mm-hmm.
not like, okay, you just have to tolerate fear. I don't believe that.
Sure.
But you have to work with it because it is. It exists.
Right. You can't just skip it or
do it. Yeah, you can't skip it. Right.
One of the questions my executive editor was getting hung up on was the difference between fear and vulnerability. He was hoping you could really clarify and make those distinct.
Sure. This, by the way, is not an unusual confusion.
Oh, okay.
Because people think of vulnerability as a feeling.
Uh-huh.
I felt vulnerable.
Uh-huh.
You know? I mean, it is a feeling.
Sure.
But it's more than that. This is the tough part because it asks people to accept something people don't want to accept.
Mm-hmm.
Vulnerability is our situation. We are vulnerable beings, period.
Mm-hmm.
That's our condition. That's our human condition. We think we're solid and fine and something can change on a dime.
Mm-hmm.
Something
mm-hmm.
can change in an instant. After this phone call, you or I could get a phone call with bad news, et cetera, et cetera.
Sure.
I'm not trying to be a downer about it. It's just reality.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we are vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that's where people don't like to go
mm-hmm.
in terms of understanding this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, just a quick example. I've taught in Florence in Italy a few times, and I taught a group of therapists there for like 3 or 4 days about this whole subject and related to addictions recovery, etc. And after the fourth day, one person raised their hand and said, "So how do you get rid of this vulnerability?" So I mean, it, you know, the person it had,
yeah,
still hadn't sunk in that we're not talking about something you get rid of.
Right.
Anyway, so that's vulnerability is our human condition, and that's what the philosophers have always called it. Our human condition is our vulnerability.
Right.
And fear is the result of the fact that we are vulnerable. So fear is actually like a reaction to our condition. Fear is not the primary emotion. Fear comes from the fact that we are vulnerable.
Can you give some common triggers? I mean, there's a million, right? But
sure,
there must be, you know, some basic categories that you see emerge.
Yeah. That's a great question. I think the most common or the biggest category is the unknown. When something's unknown, it triggers the vulnerability, which we already are, and then triggers fear or triggers something. It triggers something, the unknown.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, anxiety, which is the number one emotional problem, let's put it that way, in America at least, because we take unbelievable amount of pills for it, is because of the unknown. Anticipating something, that we anticipate that something bad or difficult is going to happen, but it's all unknown.
And we hate that.
And we hate that, yeah. And we want to make it known before it can be known.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what worry does. Worry tries to say, oh, it could be this, it could be this, it could be this. And if it's this, then I'm going to do that. And if it's that, I'm going to do this. Worry is like the planner for the unknown.
What, any others? That seems like a critical one, and it could be all-encompassing.
I think it's pretty all-encompassing because then it applies to anything that's in the future.
Yeah.
Anything.
Yeah.
You have to go to a social gathering. You have to show up at work on Monday morning. You have there's a political crisis. There's a bad weather report. Will my car start? I mean, it's almost anything unknown, from the mildest to the most dramatic, and they all trigger us. They alert us.
Uh-huh.
What's going to happen? Will I be able to handle it? But, you know, just going back to the vulnerability discussion, what's really being stimulated is our vulnerability. Because these situations are manageable or unmanageable to some degree, but what gets triggered is out of proportion to the actual situations. There's a lot of unnecessary suffering about what's going to happen. And that's our vulnerability that's being stimulated.
If you see people commonly resisting the unknown, and one of the destructive responses you've seen a lot of is drug addiction, presumably, because that sounds like you've done a lot of work in that area. But are
yeah, I don't now, but I used to. Yes.
Okay. What are some other sort of destructive responses? You talked about that gentleman who was having a midlife crisis, and he was kind of responding to things being really angry and kind of rigid. So are there other responses like that you see, other destructive responses?
Yeah, I would say that I think the destructive responses can be categorized as fight, flight, and freeze, the three instincts.
Yeah. Sure.
And I think the most destructive response is fight.
Yeah.
The amount of anger that takes place over things that really have stimulated someone's vulnerability, but they're not aware of it, and they react with anger, whether it's with their mouth or with behaviors, I think that's the single most destructive, if you want to put it in a category. It's a little less destructive if people go into flight and they try to escape things.
Mm-hmm.
They tend to harm others less.
Mm-hmm.
And the freeze response tends to harm others less.
Mm-hmm.
But the fight response, I think, is the most destructive communally.
Do you think flight and freeze can be harmful to the person?
definitely harmful to the person and can be harmful to people around them, like you didn't do something because you were afraid to do it, and there's implications for that. But fight is, I think, the most, because fight directly affects other people. Whether, and fight, you know, fight comes out in many forms. There's obviously the direct physical action. There's the sarcasm, the criticism, the getting revenge. I mean, all the forms it takes mentally.
Mm-hmm. Blaming.
Blaming.
Yeah, it seems like so. Would you even consider that a lot of anger is maybe even all anger is some kind of mask for fear?
I would say 99% of it. For 4 years, I ran a program for adolescents who were sent to this basically day hospital. They were basically thrown out of school because they were, you know, obnoxious or violent or vandals or whatever. And they were classics. I mean, you would look at them and their whole point was to look scary. They would walk and they would look scary and, you know, and so on and so forth. And, you know, after you got to know them, you know, in 20 minutes, they're like, they don't know what they're doing. They're like just hurt. I mean, I'm not excusing their behaviors, but I mean, underneath it, there is this other self that's just responding to the world with fight.
I think excusing and explaining are different.
Yes, agreed. That's good. That's a good point. I'm not excusing it by any means, but that's right.
And then if we understand it as vulnerability, I think our response to it changes. To that aggressive behavior.
Yeah.
Could you teach a kid like that to accept their vulnerability? That sort of leads us into the next question. I mean, it almost seems like you'd need a degree of maturity to be able to accept yourself or accept your vulnerability in that way. But I mean, how do you start?
I think maturity can be translated as self-awareness.
Oh.
So if you can train someone to be more aware of themselves, they become more mature.
Mm-hmm.
So if someone can notice, and that's the key thing, if someone can notice the state that they're in, they have the possibility of changing it. If someone simply reacts out of the state that they're in, there's no chance that they can change it. So they have to develop a way to notice the state they're in and to know what it is. And I don't mean like big analysis, just be able to identify it.
Mm-hmm.
Then they can choose to change it because they have a little space between the reaction and taking and doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what it takes. Then anybody can be trained in that, if you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, they can resist learning it, but I mean, they can be trained in it.
Yep. But in that case, maybe let's jump ahead for a second where you talk about techniques that you use, because those, to my ear, a lot of those sound a lot like teaching self-awareness. Like that's the first step to dealing with a fear reaction. So can you talk a little about one or two of those techniques?
Yeah. Well, I think self-awareness is the necessary. It's the prerequisite for everything else. That's the key. That's what changes things. So, how do you learn self-awareness? You have someone else help you to name your emotions, or you know, you learn how to do it yourself. But you find out how to name the state you're in. God, I'm so angry right now. You know. God, what am I so nervous about? You know, that kind of, just that gives you the chance to do something with it. If I mean, I'm just thinking about somebody who I work with who, as soon as she's nervous, she starts eating. She doesn't say she's nervous to herself and say, God, why am I so nervous? Or what is it about tomorrow that's making me so nervous? As soon as she feels nervousness, the refrigerator door is open. So she doesn't have that space where she can say, God, I'm so nervous. What I feel so vulnerable about. I mean, it's not that, you know, she doesn't have that space to talk herself through it.
Right. Before the actions have already taken over.
Right. So that's generally what the techniques are is the self-awareness, and then once you're aware, how do you change the state you're in? I think that the best way to change any of those states is through kind of a clinical or practical meditation techniques, which doesn't mean sitting in a lotus position for 20 minutes and, you know, that kind of stuff. It just means lowering the baseline, lowering the degree of alarm in the system. So it's whether it's a breathing technique or it doesn't even have to be meditating per se. It could be putting on your favorite music or whatever. But doing something instead of acting off of the feeling inside you. That's what I teach people all the time. So some people like to do mental imagery in their head. Some people like to do breathing. Some people, you know, do self-talk where they talk themselves through the feeling. But it's all about lowering the state really that the brain is in, because the brain goes into alarm. The fear center, the brain gets triggers everything, sends worry into your head, sends anxiety into your body. So how do you get that system to calm down? That's really the technique.
Right.
As in general.
Right. So it's an intervention.
It's an intervention, and it's accepting that the state I'm in can be changed.
That's a big one. Yeah, because the very nature of worry and fear thoughts is that they seem all-encompassing and as if this is all that's true.
Yes, but they're very convincing.
Yeah.
And the most convincing part is when it becomes a body state. You know, you could have thoughts in your head, which you're paying attention to, but as soon as it converts into a body state of some kind, then it's very persuasive.
Right. And it's your body trying to stay alive, right?
It's your body responding to what your brain has just done. Really, that's if you want to just break it down into, you know, the most basic steps. It's really a brain event, which becomes a mind event, a mind-body event, starting with the brain perceiving danger. I'm saying that because some people, maybe more my intellectual type clients, they like that kind of explanation. Other people don't need it, but some people really like that. Oh, it's my brain. Okay. How can I change that?
Well, and I think it depersonalizes it too.
Yeah.
It makes it feel less as if you've done something yourself, but it's your organism.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Right.
On that note, you say some people don't need it, but you do work you work with this idea of the transpersonal with
yes.
people. Can you talk a little more and explain what that means for you and how you help people understand that aspect of themselves?
Sure. The word transpersonal and the word spiritual are kind of used interchangeably. In some circles, I mean, transpersonal is not a very well-known word, but it means beyond the personal, beyond the personality. That's what the word literally means. And it's a branch of psychology that never got well-known. It started in Europe with Jung and Roberto Assagioli, and then it came to America, and it was in California and so on. But it kind of, you know, and they've had their own association and their own journal and all that, but it's sort of never gotten known. So, I mean, that's just a kind of background on it as a school of thought, I guess you could say. But really, you know, in terms of people's lives, what it means is people become convinced that they are just a mind and a body and a personality. But actually, we're much more than that. And the part of us that is beyond those things is something you have to discover through direct experience. And people do. I mean, you know, I think you mentioned your notes here about somebody who was terminally ill. I've always worked with people who are very ill because I used to work in a hospital. And I get a lot of clients now who are ill, very ill. And they're looking for something beyond the body because they know, like, you know, their time is limited. So people can make just transpersonal discoveries. And every transpersonal discovery ends up being about consciousness and energy. Mm-hmm. People go into states of, you could say, expanded or higher states of consciousness, and in which they have energy experiences that are as real as their mind and their body and their personality. In the old days, this would be the territory of religion, but religion has largely become non-experiential.
Uh-huh. More dogmatic.
More dogmatic.
Mm-hmm. So, just to press this a little bit,
sure.
Can you give an example of what an energy experience, what an experience of that seemingly intangible part of the self might look like?
It's sort of more what it feels like. Mm-hmm. What it feels like is temporarily, you're not Courtney.
Uh-huh.
Okay. What you are is a state of awareness, and it's usually characterized, which is why it makes it so attractive, it's usually characterized by bliss.
Mm-hmm.
So you're in a state of awareness in which you are immersed in bliss, and you have when you say you, it doesn't mean Courtney you, it means awareness. You are aware of bliss being connected to or participating in something which you can't name. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that these are like the conversion experiences that people have always had through history.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the states that, you know, many of the people who became religious teachers, those are the states they experienced and then tried to teach them.
Mm-hmm.
So this experience has always been known. So it's that's the nature of the experience in a general way.
So it sounds a lot like losing the personality is a way to experience bliss, or that you really can't have bliss and a personality at the same time.
Minor. You can have bliss very temporarily, but then your personality's got so many conflicts in it and so many different needs that it just revs up again.
Yep. Yeah. It gets right back in the way.
Right. But if anyone has that kind of experience of awareness and bliss, they don't forget it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it does affect them, but sometimes it just gets put in the back file. I mean, they don't sort of do anything with it. They just say, I had a weird experience once or something.
Sure.
They don't know how to integrate it into an understanding that, oh, that's part of my nature too.
So that would be the optimal outcome, right? Is if you could integrate it and know that there was something more. And that
that's
would be
right.
A kind of touchstone for you in those
that's right.
Of real anxiety.
Yes, absolutely.
That you were going to lose everything. You can't lose everything.
That's right.
You, right.
That's right. That's a very good way to put it. And I would say in traditional Christian language, I would say it's what they call the Holy Spirit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But as soon as you get into that kind of language, then it gets all tangled up and all the other stuff.
Sure.
But I would say that is a reference to that experience.
Mm-hmm.
One last thing about that on my end is that If you just hold that experience is part of people's nature,
mm-hmm.
and then you read different literature from different places, you see, oh, that's what he's talking about. Oh, that's what she means. So
mm-hmm.
people have always noted that experience and recorded it in some way.
Mm-hmm.
But then it gets symbols put on it and, you know, beliefs built up around it, and then it gets lost.
Because then it's given a personality.
There you go. That's a great way to put it. Yeah, it's given a personality. Yeah.
Yep, and then it's right back in the mix.
And then you have to support that personality.
Right. And then there's the ego problems and, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, well, good. I find that concept so interesting. So thank you for articulating that.
Okay.
I'd love to get a real strong image of how you've seen people change when they confront and accept their vulnerability and how they behave differently.
Sure. I think when someone accepts the vulnerability, a few things happen. I think they become more easily compassionate toward other people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the road to accepting your vulnerability is made easier by realizing we're all in this together. Mm-hmm. There's nobody outside of this. Nobody. It takes a while for people to get that. But then they hear about some whatever movie star or sports figure or somebody who's got cancer or died or whatever, and you know, whatever, they suddenly things get shaken up. But so the first thing I think is that people become more compassionate when they accept their vulnerability toward themselves and toward others. Mm-hmm. Which doesn't mean they love people. Mm-hmm, it just sure. means they can see, like, wow, he's struggling too. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I think that's the first thing. I think the second change that happens is they begin to have more insight into people's behaviors, including their own. Mm-hmm. They see more how vulnerability is what's generating the whole thing. I think in the book I gave the example of the business executive who's sitting down at the conference table, mm-hmm. and usually he'd be sort of intimidating and sort of motivating everybody through fear. And instead, you know, he's dealing with his own, and he just sits there, and he notices how each of his managers are actually reacting to their vulnerability. Mm-hmm. So because he's accepted his own more, mm-hmm. he's beginning to have insight into other people. Right. Which, again, I'm sorry.
And then they respond to him differently.
They respond to him differently, right.
Yeah, so it changes the whole relationship.
Changes the whole relationship, right?
Sorry,
and I think the biggest leap, and I think this is, you know, I guess you could put it all together and say it's the goal, but it's also like the biggest challenge, is to not be demanding that life be the way you want it to be. And it doesn't mean being passive. It doesn't mean being resigned. It just means being willing to love it or embrace it as it is. To me, that's the spiritual step in accepting vulnerability.